easy to put a cheaper watermelon on a store shelf that comes from another country, but it doesn't come with all the things that people value. So if you value those things, you know, support the places that are doing those things. Mm-hmm. And again, just try to educate yourself. I think that's the hardest part. A lot of consumers are just looking for an easy answer. Just try to educate yourself. And if something doesn't quite make sense, like, take that step to ask, like, does that really make sense? Like, mm-hmm. like give, you know, consumers are smart folks and they mean well, and they just want to be heard. And so continue to voice opinions, continue to demand the people that you source your stuff from, for what you want. If you want regenerative grain that's milled by a farm who cares about his soil or her soil, focus on that and support those brands. There's a lot of, it doesn't take a lot of, a lot of the farmers that are sticking their neck out there to mill their own grain and stuff. Those are big, big investments. And then those folks are literally betting the farm.
Yeah.
And they are risking their business and their livelihood, to provide consumers something that they say they want. And it's up to consumers to put their money where their mouth is and actually support those farmers.
Welcome back to our podcast, Tasting Terroir, a journey that helps you understand what makes food healthier for you and the planet. We do this by giving conscious consumers like you a deeper understanding of healthy soil and the link that it has to both the flavor and health of your food. I'm your host, Sarah Harper. That clip was from an interview I did with my good friend, Derek Azevedo, Vice President, COO, and a farmer at the Bowles Farming Company in Central California. More on the diverse set of topics that Derek will shed light on in just a minute. As you may recall from our episode last week, the big brands you have heard of are not really bringing regenerative ingredients into their products into your door. But it is starting to happen, thanks to the efforts of small, passionate food manufacturers like Around the World Gourmet in Ohio. For more on that, check out episode 7 of our podcast from last week. In last week's interview with Jennifer Coher, we explored just what it takes to bring better ingredients into products that you buy and how much power you really have to shape the course of the food industry by the decisions you make in terms of who to support. In this episode, we are featuring an interview with Derek Azevedo from California. Derek is one of those rare gems of a person who has had experiences in many different parts of the same industry, in this case, the food supply chain, and has great insights and humility about all of them. As a result, he understands deeply the challenges, trade-offs, and pressures that affect each part in the supply chain or supply circle. So if we are going to have a chance to change something as big as the food supply chain, we really need the insights of people like Derek, who understand both the pressures on the system to change, the pressures on the farmer to react and conform to the supply chain, and even the barriers from the processing and distribution sectors that he has dubbed the, quote, messy middle of the food system, the part that connects the farmer to the consumer. This conversation is almost too rich to summarize. We talk about so many valuable things across a wide range of topics, but here are just a few highlights to give you a preview. How the processing system prevents some of the most flavorful foods from getting to the grocery store. Why the food supply system is so slow to change, even with strong consumer demand pushing it to do so. Why the medical system needs to change as much as the agricultural system if we are to reap the benefits of healthier food. The important role that chefs play in connecting people to the food trends they crave. And of course, some discussion about the kinds of positive soil health practices that they take on their farm to grow a diverse set of crops from root vegetables to row crops. I hope you enjoy this wide-ranging discussion with my friend Derek and use his knowledge to help you find and support those who are literally betting the farm on creating better food for you. Here's my interview with Derek Azevedo. Hi, Derek. How are you?
I'm doing great, Sarah. How are you?
Good. Well, thanks for joining us and for sharing, you know, what over the years when I've talked to you, some of the most interesting, I think, insights come from you because you've had so many different types of agricultural experience and different positions within the supply chain. So I'm super excited for people to get to hear some of those insights today.
I'm excited too. It's always fun to catch up with you, and you've assembled such an interesting group that it's always fun to check in and catch up on the things you're working on also.
Oh, good. So, well, first of all, let people know who you are and where you come from and where you're working at now.
Great. So my name is Derek Acevedo. I'm the vice president and COO of Bowles Farming Company. Bowles Farming Company is a 163-year-old diversified row crop farm in Central California, Western Merced County, more specifically. And so, you know, over the course of 160 years, you know, every company has to reinvent themselves multiple times. And we started off as a butcher shop serving gold miners in South San Francisco, vertically integrated to a cow-calf operation with a lot of land holdings throughout California, Nevada, and Oregon. And then, you know, through the early 1900s, you know, and family succession and things like that, you know, a lot of the land was sold off. And so it would be nice to still own all of Silicon Valley and South San Francisco and all those cool places. But, and we joke around that we're farming the ground that was the hardest to sell. But we did, you know, diversify into a small grains forage crop type of farm. And our latest reinvention that's been happening over the last, you know, about 15 to 20 years has been really, and especially over the last 10 or 12 years, has been to focus on, you know, higher value, you know, more fresh market retail type products. And so cotton is still a very big part of our program, but tomatoes are as well. And, you know, the newer crops that have been performing really well for our farm has been root vegetables like carrots, garlic, onions, a lot of melons, watermelons, cantaloupes, honeydews, and mixed melons, you know, specialty grains. You know, we used to grow a lot of corn and we still do, but the corn we grow now is either corn nuts for the snack brand or sweet corn for, retail consumers. And so there's even though when you drive around the farm, it may seem like you see a lot of commodity type crops, you know, our part of the world, even those are specialized. And so just really, it's been really fun to work the crop rotations into a diverse row crop farm. It's, you know, every crop you incorporate into the mix creates an extra layer of complexity to the Gantt chart of the year. Mm-hmm. And all the different trade-offs that happen with those crops, you know, what rotations work well with others, which ones don't, which ones build on each other's, which ones we plant to build on the soil, you know. And so it's really fun to work all that in and work with a whole bunch of different customers and a bunch of different buyers and to be able to kind of combine the, you know, and listen to what the common threads of their needs are and then where the differences lie and ultimately underneath all of that, literally and figuratively, is our soil, you know. And so trying to figure out, you know, what can we do to help serve the needs of the modern consumer and also do it in a way that's practical and allows us to, you know, continue operating a business for the next 160 plus years. So yeah. Hopefully that's a big enough rundown of kind of who we are and what we do.
Yeah. Well, and I know that you all do a lot of conservation work and work with organizations, educational work too. But you have a real focus on soil health, which can be, from my opinion, maybe even more of a challenge with the kinds of fresh crops that you're growing, you know, things that you have to dig up that you can't, you know, just do no-till. So maybe just share a little bit about how you're trying to focus on soil health and kind of working with conservation groups, you know, from your perspective.
A big part of it, I think, that is perhaps the piece of soil health that you don't hear a lot of people. You hear a lot of people share a lot of opinions about soil health, mm-hmm. and you hear a lot of even science share a lot of theory about soil health. And I think where we've taken that is there's no simple solution. There's no easy answers, you know. And I think a lot of people are just seeking that. I think it was Milken that said, you know, to every complex problem in the world, there is a solution that is very clear, very simple, and wrong. And so just trying to focus on the science. Agriculture at its core is a science-based industry. You know, agronomists, crop scientists, you know, everything is science-based. And so we've been really focused on the science of, you know, this practice ends up with this result. You know, these compost applications equate to, you know, these, you know, gas emissions or these, you know, carbon improvements or the soil organic matter improvement, these till, you know, and so really trying to get through to, you know, there's multiple ways to do everything. You know, in our part of the world, you know, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of the drought that happens in California and all those types of things. We're in a Mediterranean climate, so we don't get rain in the summertime. And so when we plant a cover crop, which is a huge advantage to us, frankly, but when we plant a cover crop, we have to irrigate it. Mm-hmm. And those water resources are expensive. We're also in a very progressive state that has done a lot of work to, remove, you know, green waste from landfills and all those types of things. And so we actually have a large volume of compost we can use. And so when customers want to focus on things like building carbon, improving organic matter, and things like that, you can do it through cover crops, but we can also do it through compost. And so just introducing customers to, you know, the multiple avenues, a lot of times customers will come to us and say, we want you to plant cover crops. And a lot of farmers stop there and just try to figure out how to work cover crops into the crop rotation. But when you ask a couple different questions and get down a couple more layers, it's like, well, what are you trying to achieve? You know, and it's like, well, really what we want to achieve is we want to show that our, you know, our supply chain has, you know, positive improvements to organic matter and carbon sequestration and things like that. And it's like, well, what if we apply compost, you know, at the rates that achieve those goals, at a more cost-effective combination of inputs to this crop and do the same way with fewer resources? Does that make
sense?
But
Derek, that's not on the list. That's not on the checklist. So where do I put that? How do I?
Yeah, and that's where, you know, the strength of agriculture is creativity, really. Mm-hmm. You know, when you put the collective creative forces of farmers after a common goal, it's incredible what farmers can achieve. Incredible. I mean, we've done all sorts. I mean, we've got grapes that taste like cotton candy. You know what I mean? and so it's really about focusing on what are you trying to achieve and driving those conversations. And you can't have those conversations with just anybody. You know, you need to complete that chain of communication from, you know, the ultimate person consuming the goods and products that you're growing, or the fiber that they're wearing. And you've got to have everybody in the room that connects the dots on that chain. A lot of times the farmer's communicating with the buyer, who's communicating with with their sales team and another series of buyers and sales teams. And before you know it, you're six or eight layers removed from the consumer. And if a solution or if a product is going to have the kind of pull that changes farming services at the farm, you know, there's got to be something in it all the way through that chain in order for it to get to the consumer. And so we've done a lot of work to try to identify, you know, where are the targets coming from, who's involved, and who needs to be in the room in order to explain, here's the trade-offs all the way down the line. You know, if you want a tomato with four times the lycopene content in it than the current tomatoes that we grow, those varieties exist. We can absolutely grow them. We can mechanically harvest them. We can process them. We can incorporate them into your products today. But that tomato plant horticulturally is not very sound. It doesn't stand up to disease very well. You know, the yield is cut in half. And so in order for me to be on par, I need double the money for that. Now, if a customer really wants an incredible amount of lycopene, we can do it, you know, but what's in it for everybody in that chain in order for it to pull and deliver that all the way to the consumer? And there's a certain educational process that needs to take place in order for that to happen. So it's a really complex system.
Yeah. Well, and isn't that part of the problem that so many of these sustainability initiatives and goals and all these things that are responding to the consumer or concerns from activist groups, but like all the smart people get in the room and make up all the requirements without any of the people that are actually going to be doing it.
Yeah.
And so like if they had some of that, you know, it's like, you know, farmers are kind of like engineers, like figuring out how to make it work and how to, you know, how you do it. The how you do it, that's their whole expertise. And I know you've participated in some of these standard setting things in part to kind of help change that, right?
Absolutely. And that's where we bump into that quite a bit with the no-till conversation, the minimum till conversation, because a lot of that research and a lot of those talking points are coming from the Midwest, where they're growing a lot of small grains, you know, wheat, things like that, soy, corn, you know, a lot of those crops that aren't touching the ground when they're harvested. And so in order to facilitate the mechanical harvesting of a processing tomato, you know, we're running a machine every 60 inches down our rows that's accompanied by a 27 and a half ton set of trailers running down every set of rows, and which creates a lot of compaction, but those tomatoes are also on the ground. And so you have to pick them up off the ground. We've done no-till tomatoes. The tomatoes love it. They grow great. But if you have any wheat stubble standing up, the tomatoes work into that as they mature and get heavy. And then when the harvester comes through, the wheat mixed with the tomatoes kind of wants to smash and it damages the crop and you can't harvest it. And so you could hand pick those, you know, that would cost, you know, $80-$90 per ton, but the machine can do it for 15, you know, and so there isn't enough margin in there to facilitate hand harvest, not to mention the labor in there to facilitate the hand harvest to overcome, you know. So it's like, how do we craft, you know, a minimum till solution that facilitates, you know, the harvesting process in, you know, in cotton, the minimum till solution that facilitates the germination process. You know, a lot of these, a lot of like the tomato example is a really good one. You know, this, the strip till or minimum till tomato with a, you know, behind a cover crop process, it doesn't matter how good it works all the way through the growing process. If it doesn't work for harvest, it doesn't work. You know, and so,
yeah.
So that's where a lot of these pieces on their own may make sense, you know, or in a small plot may make sense. But in order for this to genuinely serve the biomass needs of humans, things need to scale, and they need to scale for each piece of the process. And that works not just on the farm, but that works like in the, you know, in like we call the supply chain, that messy middle of the supply chain, you know, when we offer one product and another product that's organic, regenerative, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, climate beneficial, climate smart, you know, whatever you want to call it, you're asking those folks to double their inventory space, you know, and they're already working on these very complex SKU rationalization, you know, projects and things like that, that limits their efficiency. And so there's got to be something in it for them that overcomes that obstacle. And, you know, so in modern human society, you know, everybody's more complex and everybody's more focused, more narrowly focused than we've ever been. And so everybody's world is a lot more complex than what everyone else thinks it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really the hardest part is really identifying the open-minded partners who are supported by open-minded CEOs and boards of directors who are willing to, you know, change the way they've done business. And they're out there, but they're hard to find. And when you do find them, sometimes it's hard to find a co-packer that is aligned. Sometimes it's hard to find, like in cotton, we're working on some really fun projects, but you know, a lot of the cotton textile industry doesn't even exist in the United States anymore. And so you might have the customer, you might have the you know, some other pieces of the chain, but you've got to have them all in order for it to work. And that's where, you know, identifying each valuable player in that chain is sometimes the hardest problem to solve.
And I'm glad you brought up the messy middle, because we've talked before and you've shared that concept, and I really appreciated it, you know, because most consumers, of course, have no insight into, you know, all the steps in the chain that bring them the crop out of the ground and into an ingredient and into a product. And, you know, maybe with fresh and with, you know, with things like milk or beef, you know, it's a little closer to them, or cantaloupes, you know, but certainly like wheat becoming flour, becoming bread, because, you know, there's all these steps, and each step, like you said, is more focused and more complex. And, you know, so why do you call it the messy middle? What is that? Help people that don't really have an understanding of the supply chain understand what that's describing.
I think if you just sat down and kind of pulled the, like, I don't know, I haven't done any like hardcore research on this, but the feeling I get is that the modern consumer kind of has this oversimplified version of their food shed, where their food comes from, and it's kind of like, there's somebody that grows it, you know, there's somebody that takes what you grew into what I'm going to eat. There's a truck or two in the middle, and then it's here. What's the big deal? You know, and even in the case of something like a watermelon, that's not even changing its shape in most situations, you know, that the watermelon that leaves our farm could be owned by four different people within 48 hours before it gets to a store somewhere.
Wow.
You know, and so, and we've done that. We followed, you know, we met up at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning or 3:30 in the morning at the South San Francisco produce market. And we followed our watermelons through the supply chain. And we, you know, and it was a surprise to me, you know, cause like, you know, a larger company owned them, and then they sold them to some smaller folks that went out to different distributors of this produce market, where some other folks are going and buying them and working out their deals. And it's, you know, there was like 40 booths there. And I think our watermelons were at, I don't know, 27 of them or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting to talk to some of these folks, and they were like, you're the first like farmer I've ever met. Mm-hmm. Or you're the, you know, it's like how many people that watermelon isn't food. Like to them, it's a unit that comes in and it's a unit that goes out, and we've got these targets and these goals, and that's you know, there's no incentive to them to say like there's an incentive to them to say these are great watermelons. There's no incentive to them to say like these are great watermelons, and here's the farm story, and here's the value that, you know, if they're able to negotiate a higher price for those, there's no incentive for them to give any of that to me. And so there's these pieces where, and that's where I bring in, you know, there's got to be something in it for everybody, in order to maintain the continuity of that message and deliver that. There's every single supply chain that we work with is far more complex than what a lot of folks realize. I mean, the logistics portion of our business alone is exponentially more complex than what the modern consumer has. Like there are some brilliant minds. There's some ultra sophisticated systems. There's some really tough and diligent truck drivers that pull all this together. You know, there's different state regulations on which trucks can enter which states. You know, California runs into that. You can't just take a truck and drive it from Texas to California. If it doesn't have the right engine, you can't even enter the state. You know, there's all these things that go into delivering food anywhere that it goes in this country that a lot of folks have absolutely no idea what goes into that, the risk that goes into that, the curveballs that are getting thrown in that. It's outrageous. You know, and so trying to, you know, the modern food system is so designed for big scale, mm-hmm. that when you ask to size down, it gets really hard.
Well, that's why change, I guess, is so slow. I mean, anybody that's ever heard any of my little talks knows how impatient I am with particularly the flour processing industry, who I've, you know, spent a couple of years trying to connect, you know, some of our regenerative wheat farmers. It just seemed like such an obvious play to me, which, yes. You know, because you've got flour mills, they already do some specialty or some separate runs, you know, this is a high value. And even with the nutrient density testing, you could show, you know, higher nutrient value potentially. So like there's all this added value that to me made it worth, you know, separating out, at least for a trial. And there's plenty of flour mills interested in it, but of course they don't want to pay one penny more.
Sure.
And so that was just massive. So frustrating that a number of our farmers have started to add mills to their farming operation and they're milling it themselves. And that's how it's going to get out, you know?
Exactly.
It's good for me to talk to you occasionally because you help bring humility back to my, to my world. And that's a good thing because it feels, well, especially in the contrast of how much is marketed about regenerative and yet they're not actually buying and not actually doing it. But part of what you're talking about, and you've had a great position being, you've been on the processor buying side. So you understand that role, you know, really thoroughly. Maybe just help me and help others understand. So we understand it's very complex. That's why things move so slow. So what is the consumer role in making that big system change? You know, what are the things that finally do make it change?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, and if you look at that messy middle, it's not like I don't really see it as a linear chain.
Mm.
You know, it's almost like a circle, and the farmers and the consumers are down here, and the farmer starts here and it goes around and winds up at the consumer, you know, and where you find in many cases, a lot of similarities and aligned goals are actually with the farms and the consumers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of farms and consumers who are like, why don't we do this? And it's like, yeah, we can do that. Like, well, how come it's not getting done? You know?
Yeah.
And again, it's that messy middle that kind of, there's a barrier there, and they rely on all these other folks to deliver that, but it has to come through, you know? And so I would say from a consumer standpoint, just being consistent with, you know, what do you want? And that's difficult because sometimes Steve Jobs didn't have a focus group. And the outcome of that focus group was, you know, a larger phone with a touch screen that could take pictures. You know, in the days the iPhone was produced, you know, we were going to smaller and smaller little flip phones. And it was like the smaller the phone, the better, you know, and it's almost like you have to be able to, like, sometimes the consumers don't really know what to ask for. And so really presenting the product that's simple and clear is sometimes what's best. One of the most confusing places in the grocery store to me is, you walk down the cereal aisle and you're just like bombarded by all these health claims, you know? And it's like, I'm not going to eat cereal. If I eat cereal in the morning for breakfast, it's not because I'm making a health conscious decision. You know what I mean? And it's like, you know, everything is like, you know, and so I think there is like a genuine trend in the modern consumer to just simplify, look for things that are real, you know, simple things done well is just a really nice concept that people are looking for. And a lot of it is just kind of looking for those workarounds that a lot of companies have done that for a lot of years. When we were going through the 80s and it was fat-free everything, that's when, you know, a lot more sugar started.
Yeah, what a mistake that was.
Our food. And it's just like take a step back, consumer, and say, like, does this make sense to me? I had a really good conversation, and this gets to the nutrient density and stuff a little bit. Human evolution has, you know, our senses have evolved to identify things that are good for us. And I had a fun conversation with a chemist, and he was like, the best tool I have is my nose. Mm. You know, if something smells bad, like, chances are it's really bad for you. And he's like, you know, when you're, you know, doing stuff, mixing stuff, he's like, some of the stuff that hits you and you're like, I got to be aware of this because my nose is telling me this is bad news.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's why we're attracted to vibrant colors in our food, you know, like tomato lycopene example I gave you, those tomatoes, the vine is much darker green.
Hmm.
The tomatoes are so red, they're almost purple.
Hmm.
They've got big green shoulders that kind of droop down the sides, and you cut them open and they're like, so they're almost purple inside. And that color red, you know, and so a lot of your sights and sounds and senses, you know, that we've evolved with really help slice through some of the stuff and identify, like, this one is better for me than that one. It would be interesting to kind of relay more of that to consumers and give them the opportunity to kind of trust themselves a little bit more and not, you know, it's like you're, of all of our senses, our ears are probably the least trustworthy. And, you know, and so kind of like empowering the modern consumer, because what comes with a lot of this marketing stuff is a lot of confusion and just giving consumers credit for the intelligent humans that they are and giving them something that is simple and clear is something that we can do to kind of help that process and help streamline their, you know, their feedback. And sometimes give them, like, challenge folks to say, like, if you're going to ask a consumer to contribute more, how do you prove that that actually, you know, that actual resource has actually made it back to a farm? Mm-hmm. You know, like, how do they know? And if you give, you know, consumers the opportunity to be, you know, maybe not everybody has the money to be an impact investor, but, you know, you can certainly be an impact shopper. And how do your purchasing decisions, you know, actually impact farms?
This episode brought to you by the Global Food and Farm Community, globalfoodandfarm.com, a private online space where farmers, chefs, emerging food entrepreneurs, and conscious consumers learn about and apply the latest science behind building healthier soils for a healthier world. Members also gain access to help with their marketing and communication efforts through our Grounded Growth Paddock, featuring DIY instructional videos and joint marketing projects that are designed to help small businesses find an audience for the better products they are making. The community provides new original content to members each week in the form of video interviews, scholarly articles, and the chance to ask Dr. Jill Clapperton any questions you may have each week. To get a free online tour of our digital streaming library and learn more about how this amazing resource community can help your business grow, contact me, Sarah Harper, at Sarah, S-A-R-A, at Global Food and Farm, all spelled out, GlobalFoodAndFarm.com.
A couple of things I wanted to ask you to talk more about too. So this link between, like, the vibrancy of the color and the taste, and then also I know that you've had some interesting examples of growing. You know, you grow things on the farm that, you know, you obviously taste too, and you're enjoying mm-hmm. them too. And then, so you have the ability to see, oh, wow, like cantaloupe, like this is some of the best tasting cantaloupe, but yet the system isn't built to take it. And so the consumer misses out on the thing that in theory they're looking the most for, a flavor, as well as health, which are often aligned, you know, like a really strong, good flavor is often coming from the health of the soil and the whole system. And, you know, so tell them about that cantaloupe example, which I always found sad and fascinating.
Yeah, the cantaloupe industry has been struggling. I mean, the last couple of years it's been pretty good. But, you know, over the last 15 or so years, the cantaloupe volume has been going down and the industry has just been struggling. And they incorporated a lot of genetics that they're very efficient. They grow well. You can put them on the shelf. They can sit there for, you know, I don't know how long, but they can sit there for a long period of time. They're called extended, you know, extended shelf life, you know, varieties that does a great job at reducing waste at the grocery store level. But the cantaloupe produces a lot of ethylene gas, is the natural ripening agent of plants. And when you smell that, like, big, strong cantaloupe, if anybody's ever, you know, forgot a cantaloupe in the backseat of their truck overnight and jump back in, it's like, whoa, you know, and a lot of that real vibrant smell that you have is a lot of that ethylene gas coming off. And so the varieties we used to plant, in fact, we planted a little bit of them this year and they were awesome. But they're only good for like 5 to 7 days, mm. You know, and when you pick them, the stem slips off easily. They're packed with sugar. They smell really great. But it's really difficult to get those on the East Coast and then get, you know, and so grocers see their spoil rates go up and it causes them to miss their targets. And so a lot of folks will be like, we'll just sell fewer cantaloupes, so we're not going to waste any. So we'll just, you know, keep with these newer varieties. And the newer varieties' flavor profiles are getting much better and things like that. And we'll end up, you know, getting back there eventually. But that's an example of, you know, the varieties that exist that smell and taste as delicious as the cantaloupes we all remember as children, you know, are still there. But it's just, But if you get a buyer that buys them, and then that grocery store doesn't do a good job of internal sales with their produce managers and let them know, like, hey, we've got some really good cantaloupes coming in. They're not going to.
Hey, we got to do a taste test here because people will see the difference if they taste it.
or we're not going to beat you up over having a little bit more spoilage. But right. This is, you know, like we did a project a few years ago where we put a deal together with a small grocery chain. We grew a couple fields of Western Shippers, which is an older school cantaloupe variety. And they showed up and the produce managers were like, oh, these things don't even have stems. The stems fell off and all this other stuff. And I'm like, do we live in a world where our produce managers don't even know what a full slip ripe cantaloupe looks like? And they weren't properly educated on what was coming. And so they were unhappy with the cantaloupes that showed up, despite the fact that they were great and the consumers loved them, but their spoil rates on their shelf, they didn't last as long on the shelf. And they're like, oh, these are not good. You know, and so.
But isn't that part of what the consumer, you know, in terms of helping the consumer understand to get to what they ultimately want, which is a turn back toward health, you know, by and large, yes, still convenient and simple and, you know, those things too. But there's a growing awareness of, gosh, food is such a huge part of our health. And particularly things like fresh, like vegetables, fruits, you know, that the health of those, the nutrients that they can contain versus not, and the flavor that makes you want to eat more as opposed to, you know, process stuff. So all of that, knowing that about the consumer, isn't it super important to help the consumer understand that there's a trade-off, at least in terms of, you know, the better for you stuff isn't going to last for 2 weeks. It's just not. And if it is, it's because of these other things that are not as tasty, not as healthy, you know, like just, I feel like an honest conversation about that, where I understand it's hard. People don't want to shop every other day for food and, you know, people have busy lives, all of that. But I feel like some real honesty there could be very helpful to the whole system, so that people understand that if they do want all these healthier things, tastier things, that's absolutely possible. That it's not the farmers that aren't providing it. It's the convenience patterns of the consumer that often drive what the farmers are told to make. You know?
I think that's a part of it for sure. But I also think, you know, and this is a much bigger topic, but this is where like our medical community has really failed the modern consumer. And because a lot of folks will say, you know, first thing is like, consult your doctor.
Yeah.
You know, and I can say from like my personal experiences with doctors, a lot of times, you know, as a farmer, I'll go in there and ask them some questions. And the medical community is really poorly trained in food as medicine. You know, their initial reaction to everything is chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And
isn't that ironic?
You know, and so if you talk to doctors and say, like, you know, how many in your all of your medical training, you know, how much did you study nutrition?
Mm-hmm.
How much did you study, you know, and you know, I was prescribed an antibiotic one time. And so, you know, I asked the doctor, I was like, you know, okay, this is pretty hardcore stuff. What would you recommend to, you know, repopulate my gut microbe, you know, my gut bacteria and all this other? He's like, oh, just, you know, eat organic food and you'll be fine because he like rattled off all this like nonsense. And I'm like, you realize like, no, that's true.
Mm.
And so I'm sitting there like, if this is the message that you're giving to all of your consumers, it's not moving the conversation forward.
Mm.
It's given people a confusing, it's not given the right message. It's not given the truth. You know, it's like he could have taken that as an opportunity to you know, promote food as medicine. Mm. And instead it was just like, you know, just like, you'll be fine. And that's where like, we've got to make sure like we loop the medical community into this, because we're definitely out of sync, I would say. And there's more, you know, food as medicine, there's more, you know, stuff coming out, but it's slow and it's not very sophisticated. And so having some opportunities, what we have that's really powerful is the modern consumer, for the first time, like in our lifetimes, probably is more focused on health than they've ever been. If you look at, you know, society as a whole, you know, and back a long, long time ago, you know, the wealthiest were the most overweight because they had the most access to resources, you know, and now the wealthiest are among the healthiest and the most concerned. And so if you want to see the future, like look at what the wealthiest people do. Mm-hmm. You know, the wealthiest people are the first ones to have lawns, the first ones to have toilets, the first ones to fly for recreation, the first one, you know, and so like all the things the wealthy people are doing are what winds up like trickling through all of society. And so you look and the wealthiest among us are the most health conscious in many cases. And so that's coming for the, you know, a larger and larger and larger portion of society. And so how do we as a food industry provide folks with a choice in two flours, right? One's better for you and one's not, and not just assume that nobody's going to pay more. You know, that's that's one of our biggest hurdles is like, let's give folks a choice. Let's give folks, you know, a cotton shirt that was grown under these conditions and give them the chance to feel what an extra fine, extra long staple Pima cotton sheet can do, as opposed to one that's just cheaper and filled with softening agents and all this other stuff. And so like giving folks the choice, because people genuinely do want to feel better about their decisions. They want a healthier relationship with food. And a lot of times it's just given the choice to do it is the biggest hurdle.
Well, to me, a pretty huge hurdle too is the marketing industry and the marketing of all of this, because they know, you're right, people are going in this direction, but we don't want to, or we can't change the whole messy middle to actually deliver it. So we'll just find little ways that we can pretend yeah. and maybe not outright lie, not go, you know, as far as to get sued perhaps, although but even if they don't go all the way to that extent, there's, because so many people don't know how, which practice makes a difference, which thing, you know, and because the activist community can often shine a very narrow spotlight on one thing, you know, glyphosate being an example, like everybody knows glyphosate, but they don't know the three other worst chemicals that probably you're going to push people to turn back to, because now we can't use glyphosate, you know, like they don't know any of this context. And so it becomes like a shell game of, you know, just like, oh, we've got the popular word now. We're that free, you know, BPA free, you know, well, yeah. You know, it's just,
yeah, we'll just put BPS instead.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, what you don't know can really hurt you, exactly. Especially when you're paying more and you're thinking you're getting this more pure, more better for you, supporting all the stuff that, because they're telling you that you are. Yeah. And so how that's a large part of what I want to try to do with this podcast is to, by taking people kind of inside from the ground up, starting to understand the things that at the very basic level, it's soil health, you know?
Yeah.
And so of course, if you don't have a connection back to the farm in some way, then the claims about healthier for you and all of that, you know, unless they have tests, nutrient density tests or things like that, that can objectively show you, you know, what you're doing, you should be very suspicious of, I think. But how do we deal with that? This marketing challenge, you know, that seems to help the whole kind of creaky system stay as it is, and instead of changing, because it doesn't want to change. It's built for efficiency. It's built for, like you said, scale, all sorts of food safety issues that it has dealt with well, you know, but not for flavor, not for health, not for, you know, not for a lot of other things that people now want.
Well,
solve that challenge, Derek.
Easy deal. And I think a lot of it, I learned from you, Sarah. I think it was really a brilliant move of you to include chefs in your group. It's been fun having conversations with, you know, folks like Bridget, because if you want to shape the other, like I gave the rich people example of what they do, but if you want to shape how humans eat, you know, chefs are the power players in that game. And I love working with chefs, because I spend so much time working with food buyers who are like beat over the head in their companies and they're programmed to say no.
Yeah.
When you sit down with a chef, they never, like some of them don't know what's going to show up to their restaurant on one given day or the other. And they're expected to make delicious stuff out of everything all the time. And so they're programmed to say, yeah, you know, I'll do that. You know, we had a local chef that we work with. We had a patch of watermelons and they were like a little bit bigger than softballs. And nobody wants to go in the store and buy a watermelon that's smaller than a cantaloupe, you know? And I happened to be talking to a chef friend of mine, and he's like, yeah, send me like a few cases. I'll figure something out. And we went by his restaurant like a couple of days later, and he was serving watermelon margaritas. And he was using the watermelon themselves as the cup with the straw and all this other stuff. And I was like, how brilliant is this? You know, this is the kind of products and solutions that the modern consumer is begging us to come up with, you know? And so I think really creating the space for the chefs, because the chefs are the ones who really understand, mm-hmm. you know, the stuff that tastes good.
Exactly. And the flavor connection. And increasingly they're understanding this, the connection to the soil. Like exactly. That's why their chefs are working with Jill Clapperton and, you know, people, scientists like her, because they understand that that's a way to have some predictability of good flavor.
Sure. And you'll find a lot more chefs that are much more well-versed in flavor than soil.
Yeah, giving, of course.
But giving chefs that knowledge, like including the chef community in this process, is something that you did from the very start, which I thought was awesome, because they're the ones who can really translate that. You know, at the end of the day, you and I aren't very good messengers.
Yes.
Because it's self-serving.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. But the chef isn't. They're mm-hmm. just all about like, I want to make the best stuff.
Right.
And the modern consumer isn't looking like, they're looking for their food to provide them with more than just their nutritional needs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times it's that story behind what's in that, that is what's really inspiring to a lot of folks.
Mm-hmm.
And I know like if, you know, like I'm not a big fan of duck meat, you know, but like when I go duck hunting and it's like you get those and then you cook something that you got in the wild yourself and all that stuff, like it just tastes better, you know, and having the opportunity, like giving the modern consumers the opportunity to say, I did this and this is why, or when they're hosting dinner parties for their friends and say like, I made, you know, this bread and it came from this like really cool farm that mills their own grain and it's really healthy. And I've got a woman and she's a sustainability manager for a large company that we work with. And she's all into baking and she was like, check out my wheat collection. She had like 8 different varieties of wheat and she was milling the grain at her house. And you see like sales of like home wheat mills, like going crazy. Mm-hmm. And so giving people the opportunity to work with ingredients that they feel better about is just going to continue to do nothing but grow.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, how do we position ourselves to serve that need? You know, at the end of the day, farming is just a service industry. We're just providing for others, you know? And so how do we present it in a way that's not self-serving, that we loop in the right messengers who can help like get those messages through in a defensible, but also like neutral way where it's just the truth. And it's not like, cause otherwise we're just another marketer in there.
Right.
Throwing more gas on a fire that's already out of control. Mm-hmm. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good starting point. I'm curious in terms of different practices that you've used and then, you know, tasting the fruit, the produce of that. And have you found that different soil health things lead to different, better flavors? Or, you know, we're trying to get at that connection between flavor and health. And it's still kind of an emerging science for sure, but it's definitely, there's definitely a lot of art in there. But since you do sample a lot of, you taste a lot of your own produce and you know what's going on in terms of the practices, I'm just curious if you see an overlap, like a year that you did a certain practice that you found the flavor better the next season.
I think one of the challenges with that is there are so many factors that contribute to a finished product that it's really difficult to tie something back to one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the examples that I like, the easiest way to influence that is with variety selection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can do a lot of different things with variety selection. You can do some things with irrigation practices. Sometimes, you know, like a tomato, you stress them a little bit at the end. You know, you can
by not giving them as much water.
You can, yeah, exactly. You can concentrate. You know, you can see concentrated flavors and things like that a little bit. You know, one of the practices that we've maintained for a long time that I think contributes a lot to our soil health is we've had a long history of applying chicken manure fertilizer to a lot of our fields. And you see when various diseases in our area were popping up, Fusarium race 3, some of the verticillium and the cotton, those types of things, they didn't seem to affect our farm as much as some of the other farms in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that may not translate to a lot of flavor, but it certainly translates to a lot of health and disease resistance and prevention and those types of things, which ultimately contribute to just healthier, more productive plants. Mm-hmm. And you know, we don't have to treat them for as many things. And so it's difficult to say, you know, like an easy example is if you want a spicier onion, I'll just put a lot of sulfur on the ground the fall mm-hmm. before I plant that onion. Mm-hmm. And we can get your onions too hot. You know, and so there's some of those that are kind of linear, like I applied this and this was the result, that are a little mm-hmm. bit easier to tie. But again, it's really hard to tie them all together because everything is tied to everything else.
Right.
And so what I try to do is really maintain a really diverse rotation, you know, and depending on the irrigation systems that we have, depending on the crop rotation, I'll you know, mix the tomatoes and onions and carrots, and depending on where the drip replacement stage is, and then it's constantly throwing different stuff at the fields. If we have the chance and the time, you know, we'll go in with multi-species cover crops in the fall, and just try to keep, you know, I just look at the microbes in the soil, like the crop on there is the like that's the food source, you know, mm-hmm. and so. By throwing different food sources at our microbes, we're giving, you know, our soil a lot of competing communities in their kind of equal playing ground to be able mm-hmm. to compete with each other effectively and to yeah. prevent those diseases from even coming in the first place. And so I would like to get to a point where, you know, we're doing things for flavor and we're doing things for nutrition, but the biggest gap in that is I get zero feedback as right. a farmer yeah. into which of our products tasted the best, mm. which of our products were the most nutrient dense, which were, you know, and so I look at it like, who knows, maybe what I think is a great, you know, honeydew isn't the most nutrient dense, but I'm being rewarded for a honeydew that is of this size and of this right. shape and of this, you know, of these other measurable quality attributes. And so to the extent that we develop a culture of providing feedback to farmers into which of their products are providing the most, that'll give us the insight into optimizing those targets as mm-hmm. opposed to the ones we're optimizing now.
Yeah.
Like in processing tomatoes, for instance, right now we're like, we have very good numbers on pH, sugar, you know, if there's, you know, how much mold is in there, how many broken tomatoes are in there, all those types of things. And there's hundreds of tomato varieties to choose from. And when I sit down and talk to the breeders, I ask them, well, which one tastes the best? And they're just like, I don't know. Like, who cares? And the market tomato folks.
It's how it fits through the machine that turns it into sauce. That's the important thing.
The market tomato guys are different. Like, they're yeah. a lot more focused on
yeah.
Flavor profiles and things mm-hmm. like that. And the breeders are always have their like little side project.
Which is funny because tomatoes are one of the things that you hear consumers complaining about the most, like the tomatoes that you buy in the store that yeah. look beautiful, but have like practically no flavor.
Exactly. And they're all harvested green.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to give the tomato credit, they taste pretty darn good for as green as they harvest them, you know? And so they're not even given they're green with dark gel and maybe a blush of color on the inside when they harvest them. And so they're pretty darn good for being harvested premature. Mm-hmm. Those same tomatoes, if you leave them in the field for another 10 days, or you just, at the time of harvest, you go in there and just harvest the red ones, mm-hmm. they're amazing. They're mm-hmm. on par with heirlooms and all those other tomatoes. Mm-hmm. They just aren't tough enough to stand up to the rigor of transportation and yeah. grading in their red form. And mm-hmm. so that's why they're harvested green. Because they're tough enough to be stacked in a
trailer, be transported
and be graded yeah. before they're put into small boxes and then shipped to stores. You know, mm-hmm. so that's where it's that messy middle of food. You know, the tomato needs to facilitate the needs of those folks in order to get to the store to look pretty. If we managed the modern market tomatoes like we managed heirlooms, they would be every bit as good. And we get tons of compliments on our tomatoes that are left behind after harvest. And so that's
well, I'm
that's
sure, where, yeah. Yeah, you're in, you know, you're in the amazing land of fresh food. So
and that's where like they've genetically, they're pretty darn strong from a mm-hmm. flavor profile standpoint to be premature and still be acceptable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things, like just understanding like the pieces that all need to fit, it's gotta work, you know, it's gotta work for everybody, you know.
But doesn't that argue then for, you know, more of a market for a lot more local tomato growers that just serve us, you know, a certain radius, you know, instead of trying to ship everybody everything from one spot.
Kind of, but again, you get into, there's a ton of efficiency that comes with.
Right. So exactly how much more are you willing to pay for that amazing ripe tomato?
Exactly. And so there's an incredible amount of efficiency that comes with, you know, the harvest activities. We can come get, you know, 2.5 truckloads of tomatoes per acre at one time. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go back and come back and get what's left behind, there's not as many tomatoes available. So your harvest cost goes way up. Yeah. You know, they're not as tough. So your packaging material cost goes way up. And that's why when you go to the store and you see an heirloom tomato for $13 a pound or whatever in the world they are, you know, a lot of times it's because of how many efficiencies are lost by allowing them to ripen. And there's a lot of risk. And then and then you shift more, you know, more reliability on human labor to harvest them and pack them. And labor resources are tight and incredibly expensive. And so that's where there's a lot of pieces into the why. Mm-hmm. So there's, I don't know. We can go on forever about
this is super helpful for me for sure. And I'm sure for a lot of folks that want to understand their food system better and that want to use the power that they have as consumers in ways that are really helpful. So I guess maybe let's end on that. And, you know, you've mentioned some things, but if, you know, what are one or two things that you think as a consumer that they should stay focused on in terms of an action that they can take?
The actions consumers can take, continue to try to eat healthy, mm-hmm. you know, continue to try to eat the things that are on the outside of the grocery store and try cooking them yourself. You know, those are basic, you know, and try the different things. You know, if you haven't tried, you know, Belgian endive or those types of things, it's amazing how good the modern food system is. Mm-hmm. And the other side of it is look at where things come from. At the end of the day, every bite of every food that we eat comes from a farmer somewhere. There's never been a bigger disparity in growing practices, environmental practices, worker protections, all kinds of stuff than there's ever been as now. Mm-hmm. And so looking for the places, like if you really, whether it's organic or conventional, American and especially California grown stuff is held to the highest regulations in the world for worker protections and environmental protections and training and, you know, all these different things that go into protecting the people, the environment, and the process of where the food comes from. Having all of those protections is expensive. It's easy to put a cheaper watermelon on a store shelf that comes from another country, but it doesn't come with all the things that people value. So if you value those things, you know, support the places that are doing those things. Mm-hmm. And again, just try to educate yourself. I think that's the hardest part. A lot of consumers are just looking for an easy answer. Just try to educate yourself. And if something doesn't quite make sense, like take that step to ask, like, does that really make sense? Like, mm-hmm. like give, you know, consumers are smart folks and they mean well, and they just want to be heard. And so continue to voice opinions, continue to demand the people that you source your stuff from, for what you want. If you want regenerative grain that's milled by a farm who cares about his soil or her soil, focus on that and support those brands. There's a lot of, it doesn't take a lot of, a lot of the farmers that are sticking their neck out there to mill their own grain and stuff. Those are big, big investments. And then those folks are literally betting the farm.
Yeah.
And they are risking their business and their livelihood to provide consumers something that they say they want. And it's up to consumers to put their money where their mouth is and actually support those folks.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Great place to end. Thank you so much, Derek. Really appreciate your time. And just let people know, is there a website that they can go to or where can they buy your produce if they're in California?
Oh man. There's a bunch. You can go to our website. It's under construction a little bit right now, but it's bfarm.com. Is the Bowles Farming Company website. And then we're in the process of updating some stuff, but we'll have a list of labels and things like that, that we don't put a lot of our own stuff on our own label in stores. We really see our role as being the strong farming partner that co-brands with mm-hmm. folks. And so our watermelons, cantaloupes, honeydews, those are marketed under the Majesty label. Sweet corn is under Glorianne. You can find all that stuff in Costco's. you know, a lot of our tomato products go out into other stuff, but we grow a lot for the ketchup companies and those types of folks. And so we'll have, you know, give us a few weeks, but we'll have all of our brands and labels and stuff like that on the website. But there's a lot of cool stuff there. We've got, you know, we're not a very big farm. We're just, you know, we're very open to feedback, and we're also very interested in just connecting to consumers and finding out what's important to them so we can position ourselves to provide for them in the future.
You've been listening to Tasting Terroir, a podcast made possible by a magical collaboration between the following companies and supporters, all working together to help farmers, chefs, food companies, and consumers to build healthier soil for a healthier world. Rizoterra. Owned by Dr. Jill Clapperton, Rizoterra is an international food security consulting company providing expert guidance for creating healthy soils that yield tasty, nutrient-dense foods. Check us out at rizoterra.com. That's RIZOTERRA.com. And the Global Food and Farm online community, an ad-free global social network and soil health streaming service that provides information and connections that help you apply the science and practice of improving soil health. Join us at globalfoodandfarm.com. And from listeners like you, who support us through our Patreon account at patreon.com/tastingterroir. Patrons receive access to our full-length interviews and selected additional materials. Patrons will also have the opportunity to submit questions that we will answer on the podcast. Tune in next week to hear more interviews and insights with myself, Sarah Harper, and Dr. Jill Clapperton, as well as the regenerative farmers, chefs, and emerging food companies in the Global Food and Farm online community and beyond. If you like our work, please give us a 5-star rating and share the podcast with your friends. Thanks so much for listening and for helping us get the word out about this new resource to taste the health of your food. Until next week, stay curious, keep improving, and don't stop believing that better is possible when knowledge is available.